So, we've been studying and practicing together these past months the teaching in the Lotus Sutra of the truth, the ultimate truth of no birth and no death. We learned that the Buddha said people in the world tend to believe in one of two views, the view of being or the view of non-being. Hamlet is a famous example of this kind of thinking. He proved the Buddha's point when he said, to be or not to be, that's the question. We discovered that this is a legitimate kind of question in the world of conventional truth. But we learn that this thinking that we either be or not be does not conform to the Buddha's ultimate truth of no being and no non-being. We learn that we can never be by ourselves alone. We always, so we were introduced to the ultimate truth of interbeing. We can never die because we always will interbe. And we have never been born because we have always interbeen. Well, this is a truth that takes some getting used to. We're told in the Lotus Sutra that when the Buddha first taught this ultimate truth of no birth and no death, his hearers couldn't believe it. I mean, even those bodhisattvas and venerables and experienced lay and monastic practitioners, hearing the news in this atmosphere of faith from the big dog himself, literally couldn't believe the truth that we were never born and never will die. So it took some convincing on the part of the Buddha. But when they finally got it, you can imagine they were ecstatic. They were so happy that they had never been born and that they would never die. That theirs and therefore ours is an infinite lifespan. So then, after all the hearers had caught their breath from this good news about the infinite lifespan, the Buddha taught about merit. In the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha said that anyone who has the opportunity to hear the ultimate truth about no birth and no death, even folks who hear the teachings after they've been handed down 2,500 years, folks like us, if while listening to the teachings we begin to feel some joy and contentment and faith in the teachings, even if for only one little thought instant, he said, we will receive infinite merit. And so what's meant by infinite merit? Our teacher Thay says, merit is a kind of spiritual energy that can be accumulated when we maintain a steady, joyous practice. So then, in our e-talks and our conversations with our sanghas, we learned what to do with all that infinite merit that we accumulate by understanding and living the ultimate truth of no birth and no death, of interbeing. We learn that we share it with others. We share it by the way we mindfully live our lives. Thay says, when we live in mindfulness, it's as if there are rays of light coming from the pores of our body that touch all those who are around us. Then, even if someone does not yet have the practice, when they get in touch with the light of our mindfulness, they begin to give rise to the seeds of mindfulness within themselves. This is a natural process and doesn't require a lot of striving or effort on our part. So last month, in his e-talk, our teacher Chan Wei gave us a beautiful picture of how we might share our light of mindfulness. He said, when there's one light in a room, it brings some radiance to the room. But when each of us is a light with mindfulness, the room really glows, shines. And if our light goes out, it's very easy in a room full of light to relight our mindfulness. So mindfulness is one way to practice the ultimate truth of interbeing. Today we're introduced to another way to practice this ultimate truth. In the 23rd chapter of the Lotus Sutra, we're introduced to the Bodhisattva Medicine King. So this Bodhisattva is someone who, well, may be a symbol of a person or may be a symbol of characteristics of a person. Each Bodhisattva is a doctor with a specialty. So the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion, and she specializes in deep listening. And Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom, so his specialty is keen awareness. And then Samatamhadra is the Bodhisattva of great action, who specializes in the Dharma practice. So the Bodhisattva Medicine King has an interesting story. He wasn't always called a Medicine King. His name had been Bodhisattva Seen with Joy by All Beings, because when all beings saw him, they felt joyful. All beings, not just human beings, because Bodhisattva Seen with Joy by All Beings had the ability to turn himself into all kinds of living beings in order to teach them. So if a dog needed his teaching, he turned himself into a dog. And if a woman needed his teaching, he became a woman. And to serve an evil person, the Bodhisattva turned himself into an evil person. And then I think after he and the evil person did their evil stuff, then he'd say, hey, this isn't so great. Let's stop doing evil stuff and do good stuff. So the Bodhisattva Seen with Joy by All Beings went to a lot of trouble and used a variety of skillful means to teach the ultimate truth of the Lotus Sutra, of interbeing. When all beings, including all Buddhas, loved this Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva Seen with Joy by All Beings loved all beings. And he was devoted to and had faith in and was grateful to all Buddhas. So in gratitude to the Buddhas whom he loved so much, Bodhisattva Seen with Joy by All Beings offered his offered his true mind to them. But then we're told in the Lotus Sutra that he got to thinking, you know, it's really good to offer my true mind to the Buddhas, but it's not as good as offering my body. So Thay continues the story. So out of his great love and gratitude, and with the profound insight into his ultimate nature, interbeing, he was able to relinquish his body very easily. The sutra tells us that as an offering to the Buddha and to display his insight that his body is not a permanent, unchanging self, the Bodhisattva drank incense and the oil of yellow flowers. And he smeared his body with fragrant oil, and he wrapped himself in heavenly robes, and he poured fragrant oil over himself. And then he used intense energy of his meditation and concentration to set himself on fire. And he burned his own body. His body burned for 1,200 years. And we're told in the Lotus Sutra that the light shone everywhere throughout the world in number to the grains of sand in 80 Ganges rivers. So all the Buddhas who witnessed his offering praised the Bodhisattva. They didn't praise him because Buddhas like burned bodies as offerings. That's not it. Thay explains, this is a quite radical demonstration of the Bodhisattva's freedom and insight, one that was made out of very deep love. So the Buddhas praised the Bodhisattva because of his love and because also Bodhisattva, seen with joy by all beings, had realized that he was not his body. His body was empty, empty of a separate self. So this Bodhisattva taught the teaching of the Lotus Sutra by his action of setting his body on fire. So after 1,200 years, Bodhisattva, seen with joy by all beings, died, and he was born again as the Bodhisattva Medicine King. Now, knowing his resume, his biography, we're not surprised that Bodhisattva Medicine King specializes in teaching the ultimate truth of interbeing using devotion, gratitude, and faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So Bodhisattva Medicine King is called the Bodhisattva Devotion, Faith, and Gratitude. So let's look at his teaching on gratitude. The practice of gratitude does not come naturally to me. I've had to call on several teachers. So I'd like to share some short teachings from three of the teachers who've helped me with my practice of gratitude. This first one is from the Buddha, and he's given a lot of talks on gratitude, but this one I think is particularly relevant for today. So the Buddha said, let us rise up and be thankful. For if we didn't learn a lot today, at least we learned a little. And if we didn't learn a little, at least we didn't get sick. And if we got sick, at least we didn't die. So let us all be thankful. This next teaching comes from my teacher, Willie Nelson. He said, when I started counting my blessings, my whole life turned around. And then this last is from a letter from Paul, who was in my meditation class at the jail. And when he left to serve his 6-year sentence in prison, we began writing to each other. So this is a little excerpt from one of his letters. I think you'll see what a good student he is. So Paul says from his prison cell, everything here is as good as it can be. Even though I am in prison, I keep reminding myself that I already have more than enough conditions to be happy. Not to toot my own horn, but people around me have picked up on this and they check me if I'm not my smiling self. That actually feels pretty good. So I'd like us to experience together, all of us, all of our sanghas together, a gratitude meditation. And my sister Gail said that she'll invite the bells for us. So if you'll get in your meditation spaces, we'll listen to the three bells, and then I'll offer this guided meditation, and we'll end with one bell. Lord Buddha, please allow me to express my gratitude and appreciation to you. If there were not the Buddha, if there were not the wonderful Dharma that the Buddha has taught, if there were not the Sangha body that practices and preserves this wonderful Dharma, how could I experience such happiness today? The understanding and compassion of the Buddha has ended in me so many worries, fears, and misunderstandings. Even if I had 100,000 lifetimes to show my gratitude for the grace of this understanding, it would not be possible for me to do so. The practice of gratitude is a very healing practice. I've noticed that it's hard for me to be self-centered when I'm grateful. Hard to crave when I'm grateful. It's hard for me to be grouchy when I'm grateful. In fact, I've noticed that when I'm grateful, I'm happy. My daddy used to say, "When mama's not happy, nobody's happy." My daddy wasn't a Buddhist, but what he said is true because of the Buddha's ultimate truth of inner being. I am in my mama. My mama is in me. So when my mama is not happy, I really am not happy. My mama and I inter are. By the way, I can still be grouchy and self-centered and crave stuff that I think I need, but it's just harder when I'm practicing gratitude. So we see that the Bodhisattva Medicine King taught the truth of inner being by practicing gratitude. He also used faith to teach inner being. So faith. That's the hard one for some of us. Some of us have the idea that faith means dogma, means do it because I say to do it, means don't ask questions. So some of us have removed faith from our practice. Some of us have replaced faith with confidence. So we might need to relax our minds and open our hearts to be able to receive the teachings of faith in the Buddhist context. The Buddha always taught honest skepticism. From his very first teachings to literally the one that he gave on his deathbed. He said, don't automatically believe what I say. Test it out. Test it for yourself. But our teacher, Tai, says, without faith, it's not possible for human beings to live. He doesn't say blind faith, but he says without faith, it's not possible for us human beings to live. So at first glance, it looks like there's a little bit of tension here between rational judgment and direct experience and faith. So I wanted to see what faith looks like in the Buddhist teachings. So I looked at the Buddha's favorite Dharma talk, the Four Noble Truths. So the first noble truth tells us to acknowledge our suffering. This is the opposite of what we've been taught by our culture, which teaches us to hide or distract ourselves or ignore or pretend that we're not suffering. But the Buddha asks us to use our reasoned judgment and direct experience to accept and even embrace our suffering. But it takes at least a little bit of faith to just try such a radical idea. Faith in ourselves that we can do it, and also faith that this might be beneficial. So the second noble truth is, the Buddha said, investigate your suffering. Well, that he means by investigate direct experience and reasoned judgment to analyze. Get down deep there and look at the causes of your feelings. Look at under what conditions they arose. So we have to have faith that such a painful investigation will benefit us. And we have to have faith that we can do it. We can look deeply. So the third noble truth is to quit creating your suffering. So we have to have faith in free will. That our suffering is not preordained for us, predetermined. We have to have faith that this is a goal we can reach. And then the only way we can reach it is through reasoning, logical thinking, and direct experience to examine the obstacles to our happiness and the causes of our happiness. So then the fourth noble truth is, the Buddha says, so, okay, y'all, here's this path to happiness. And it's made up of eight things, these particular eight things. You know, right view, right thinking, speech, action, and so on. So we have to use our reasoning and our direct experience to be able to experiment with these eight elements of happiness. But we also have to have faith that a path exists and that it's these particular eight things that are on the path. So this is really wonderful that we see in the Buddhist context that we need faith in order to be able to make the effort of reasoned judgment and look at our direct experience. And we need reasoned judgment and direct experience because they develop, nourish our faith. So it takes faith in the Buddha, faith in the teachings, faith in ourselves to even begin the process of reasoned judgment. And it's logical, reasoned thinking that develops our faith. And then when we benefit from a practice, it develops our faith and our practice, which encourages us to use our reasoning and our direct experience, which builds our faith. So we can see that in the Buddhist context, faith and reasoned judgment, direct experience, enter our listening key. Use the tool of faith to teach inner being. So the last of the Bodhisattva Medicine King's tools for understanding and practicing inner being is devotion, which means loyalty, a love, admiration. It doesn't mean worship. So this is what our teacher Thay says about devotion. You might wonder how devotion and affection are part of the practice of looking deeply and attaining enlightenment. Do we need love? Do we need to love our teacher? Do we need to love our disciples? Do we need to love our Dharma brothers and sisters in order to succeed in our practice? The answer is yes. Just as the loving presence of the parents is quite critical for the growth of a baby, the loving presence of a teacher is very important for his or her disciples. The loving presence of our brothers and sisters in the Sangha is very important for us to grow as practitioners. That's the message sent forth by this Bodhi. So what causes us to be devoted to our teachers, the Dharma, and our Sangha? When I asked myself that question, I answered, I don't know. Because I couldn't think of anything that causes me. I feel devoted. I love the Buddha. I love the Dharma. I love the Sangha. But it seems like it just happens, like by osmosis somehow. But when I thought a little deeper, I noticed that there are four ways that I think have opened my heart to a devotional practice. So maybe these four things are ways to open ourselves to the practice of devotion. The first one is getting to know the Dharma, getting to know the teachings of the Buddha and Thay and Chanwi and our other teachers. Their teachings on love, compassion, understanding, kindness, gratitude, inner being, these teachings are like medicine for me. The teachings are beautiful. In Thay's teachings, they're even poetic. But they're also very practical, concrete tools for living with myself and for living with others. So my gratitude for the Buddha's and Thay's teachings on all their teachings, I give birth, I think, to a deep feeling of devotion. So another way to open my heart to the devotional practice is to get to know the Buddha and Thay as real people, as children and teenagers and young adults and old men. Because both of them were real, vulnerable, honest people, not gods, not even unreachable teachers. So I have learned from their stories by relating to their stories. For example, when the Buddha was a little boy, Siddhartha, before he was a Buddha, agriculture hadn't been in use for very long. And so it was a really big deal the first day of plowing. They had a big festival, a big celebration. I picture everybody bringing their picnics and sitting it out under the trees and kids running around everywhere, maybe music, people singing. So the Buddha was there for that big happy celebration, but when he saw the plow turn up the dirt and it cut little worms, Siddhartha cried out in pain. Well, when I was a little girl, maybe about 10, about the age of Siddhartha, I think, at the time of the plowing, my family decided to go on a big vacation, a road trip to Colorado. And it was a really big deal. My mama took pictures of us, made it into a slideshow. We kind of had to pose for my daddy, pretended like he was trying to get all the clothes in the suitcase. And my mom, my sister and I were looking at the map like that. I made up a whole big slideshow. In those days, a slideshow meant slides. You put in this machine, you go, tink, 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 tink. So it was such a happy time. We all jumped into our car and drove from Houston to West Texas, and we were filling up with gas at a filling station when a dog was hit by a car. The dog wasn't killed, but he was hurt, and he was crying out in pain, and I started crying as well. And you can see that I remember it 60 years later. So I know that pain that the Buddha talks about. When Tai was a young man, he fell in love with a nun. And the way he tells his story is so beautiful. He was a young monk and she was a young nun, and they were working together on a project. And then they left to go to their rooms at night. And he talks about staying up all night in his room thinking about her, wanting to get up and go knock on her door and say, let's meet in the meditation hall, but he didn't want to bother her. Couldn't sleep for thinking about seeing her in the morning. So I know that same kind of yearning and sweet heartache. During the American-Vietnam War, several of Tai's friends and students were murdered in Vietnam. And he talks achingly about his grief. He wrote a play about it, and he wrote poems about it, and he's written stories about it, about the way he suffered from this tragedy. Well, my best friend in the whole world, Scotty, went through the windshield when a pickup truck hit her car. And it took the jaws of life to get her body out. So I know this grief that Ty knows. The Buddha and Ty cry. They have belly aches. They're frustrated. They're angry. They do goofy things. Remember that the Buddha walked around naked in the woods for a couple of years, and that he almost starved himself to death. That qualifies as goofy. Well, I cry, and I have belly aches, and I get frustrated and angry, and I do stupid things. The Buddha and Tai deal with those intense feelings and physical pain in wiser, kinder, quicker, and I imagine less dramatic ways than I do. But still, they experience the human joys and sufferings that we all experience. Hearing their stories, their personal stories, I don't get discouraged by their tears and fears and frustrations and anger. In fact, it's their humanness that makes my humanness okay. It makes my heart soften. Their stories soften me. What I mean by soften me is this. When my precious brother in Miami, Antonio, found a new apartment that he liked, I was so happy. And when my sister Gail's sister Sharon died after a long illness, I ate for her and her family and Sharon's family. I remember last fall at the retreat in Deer Park. It was the first sit of the morning. And so Ty was sitting in meditation on this platform. And I'm one of his 900 students sitting knee to knee on the floor in the dimly lit meditation hall. And my eyes are supposed to be closed, but I'm watching my teacher and watching the sun's morning light start to fill the room, spilling over on my sisters and brothers. And I'm just filled with gratitude and love and devotion. I get teary. That's what happens to a heart that's softened by devotion. I feel that I am interbeing. So there's several sources for getting to know the Buddha. I love Thay's book, Old Path, White Clouds, of the Buddha's story. And to get to know Thay, almost all of Thay's books, maybe all of them, Thay tells some of his stories. But one of my favorites is Cultivating the Mind of Love, because that's the one where he talks about falling in love. He also wrote a children's book, Under the Rose Apple Tree, where he tells the Buddhist life story and his own life story. So a third way to open our hearts to this devotional practice is through chants, practice songs, touching the earth, and guided meditations like the gratitude meditation we did together earlier. Some of us don't like the practice of touching the earth, of prostrations. Seems too ritualistic. We ask, how can bowing deeply nourish devotion? And some of us don't really like the practice songs. I've heard people say they're too simple, too childish, kind of silly. How can those songs nourish our devotion? And some of us don't really like chants. They're too ritualistic, too weird to whine in some dead language. And those drums and flutes and singing bells, too liturgical. How can those chants nourish my devotional practice? Well, Thay's teachings of inclusivity encourages us to consider, even honor, all wholesome forms of devotional practice. So to nourish your practice of devotion through meditations and chants and songs, I recommend touching the earth, intimate conversations with the Buddha. That's where that gratitude meditation that we did earlier came from. And I recommend chanting from the heart, kind of a Thich Nhat Hanh Bible. Also, a blooming of the lotus, which contains a lot of wonderful guided meditations. And a basket of plums, which are songs that you can download free if you just Google a basket of plums. So one last way I'd like to offer you to cultivate the practice of devotion is to imagine our teachers as if they're actually present. When I picture the Buddha or Thay sitting in meditation with me, doing walking meditation with me, or offering the Dharma talk, or washing dishes, I feel safe and protected. I feel capable of doing the right thing. I talk to them. Jennifer, my daughter Jennifer, gave me that bumper sticker, "What Would Buddha Do?" I really like it. I didn't put it on my bumper, because I wanted to put it in my office so that it would remind me that the Buddha is around for me to call on. So I say, "Hello Buddha, are you there?" And the Buddha always says, "Yes, dear one, I'm here for you. Are you always there for me?" And sometimes I say, "Dear Thay, how should I answer this email?" Like that. So having my teachers with me, I feel more confident. I'm more honest with myself. I'm more diligent. And because I want to look good, right? In the eyes of the Buddha, in the eyes of Thay. I want to do good. Well, it just makes me happy to have them hanging around me. So maybe we can cultivate our devotion by bringing our teachers into our daily lives. But I got to tell you that Thay, our practical, action-oriented teacher, throws up a little red flag about devotion. Here's what he says. "We should not underestimate the practice of devotion. Devotion is not enough. It must go together with the practice of meditation, of looking deeply, and the practice of compassion in action." So, a couple of last words about the practice of offering gratitude for faith in and devotion to our teachers, the teachings, and our community of sisters and brothers. I've noticed that those of us who love, who are devoted to Thay, to the Buddha, to the Dharma, and to the Sangha, to our Sangha brothers and sisters, we who love them find it easier to practice and easier to be happy. And although I imagine they must be very happy to receive our practice, I notice that it's really I who benefits from this practice of gratitude, faith, and devotion. Me and those around me. Because this practice of offering gratitude for faith in and devotion to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is a training in love for all beings. It's a very strong way to train ourselves to be good lovers of everyone. So, Please, during your Dharma sharing time, share the ways you experience gratitude, faith, and devotion to your teachers, the teachings, and your community, brothers and sisters in the Sangha. Or it would be helpful to share your age, your discomfort around these devotional practices taught by the Bodhisattva Medicine King of gratitude, faith, and devotion. You remember the last time Chanhui asked me to be his substitute teacher. I got the word about 30 seconds before we started. You remember maybe that I shared with you a very good teaching from my grandbaby, Precious Purple. Well, her name is Shay, but her oma calls her Precious Purple. My grandbaby, Precious Perfect, who said after she had come to a retreat at Plum Blossom and she had gone to one of Chanhui's Dharma talks, she came out and I said, Precious, what did you think? And she said, Amma, Dharma talks are just common sense dragged out. So I've dragged this out as about as long as I can drag. So I just want to say thank you to Antonio and Gail for helping me yesterday and today. And thank you to my Sangha who has heard most of this talk, but they stayed quiet here most of the time. And only one or two got up and left. And I want to say thank you to all my sisters and brothers all over North America, Canada, and Mexico, and the United States. Thank you for being open and for being flexible and for being the kind sisters and brothers that you are.